Sports Talk New York with your hosts Mark Rosenman and AJ Carter. Sports Talk New York is sponsored in part by Prince Associates, Send in the Clowns, the Phoenix Tube Company, CelebrityTrips.com, the law firm of Decalator Cohen and DePrisco, Solomon Jewelers, and Relish Restaurant of Kings Park. Here are your hosts, Mark and AJ.
And joining us now live in studio is a man who has been a staple in the New York sports scene for three decades, covering such events as the World Series, the Super Bowl, the NBA Finals, NHL Playoffs. He started out, as many others have, on Sports Phone, and then as a reporter at ABC Radio Sports. He has worked at FAN, AP Radio, Sirius Satellite Radio, and currently covers the New York Mets for 1050 ESPN Radio. He is the author of an amazing new book, Press Box Revolution, which chronicles the evolution of sports reporting, taking readers into corners of the press box and locker room they have never seen. Pressbox Revolution is a must-read for all well-informed fans and aspiring sports journalists, as well as those of us in the media. It is a thrill to welcome him here in studio, the pride of WFUV Radio, Rich Catino to WLA Sports Talk New York. Welcome, Rich.
Mark, thank you very much for the kind words, and coming from someone that has authored so many great books like you have, it's a privilege to be in here with you today.
Thank you. We're looking forward to this. AJ and I have been talking about this ever since we got the book. We may as well start the journey with WFUV. You look at Fordham and what they produce as far as broadcasters, and it's basically the San Pedro de Macorís of shortstops from the 70s and 80s. Notable alumni include Vince Scully, Michael Kay, Mike Breen, Bob Popper, our APM guest John Giannone, and yourself. So what is it about WFUV and Fordham that allowed so many people to thrive and have the confidence to make it in the industry, not only in the industry, but in a marketplace? Those names I just mentioned, for the most part, biggest markets there are.
I think it's the leadership at Fordham University. I really believe that. I think it's their belief in the radio station, their belief in how important it is to not only helping the students that are there, but recruiting students that are thinking of going to college. And one of the things that I found out when I got into WFUV is that I learned a lot from a lot of the people in there. And I learned what I was good at and what I was not so good at. And one of the things that in my time there, there was no WFAN. There was no internet. Yeah, I'm an old guy. There was nothing that people could listen to on a Sunday night after the NFL other than one-on-one. And I'm kind of proud to have been part of New York's longest-running sports telephone talk show. And in those days, we used to pair guys that work well together. Michael Kay would always be paired with Mike Breen because they worked together on the show. And Charlie Sloz and I would always be paired together. And I learned an awful lot from Charlie. Charlie, who was the play-by-play guy for the Washington Nationals. And just learned about something that I read about Gil Hodges and Tom Seaver early in Tom's career when Gil said, "You have to be a professional every moment of the day that you can be in this business." And it's something Charlie taught me. And Charlie and I and Mike Breen, this is the real funny part about FUV, we all grew up about maybe 3 miles from each other in Bronx/Yonkers, and we didn't know each other at all. We spent 3-4 years together at WFUV, seeing each other every day, and now we're friends for life. And there were so many of those kind of relationships at WFUV. It opened doors for us. I got to cover Met games in my sophomore and junior year of college. I got to do one-on-one interviews with guys like Rusty Staub and Joe Torre when he managed the Mets. Yes, Joe Torre managed the Mets. And it was just a great way to get into the business. And that and the combination of Sports Phone, as I wrote in the book, I think were the two best farm systems in the business. We didn't make a heck of a lot of money working there, but we learned a lot of things that we brought to our careers, and we'll always be thankful to those places.
How does it work in terms of the networking going forward? Now, you think of the great broadcast schools. There's Fordham, and there's probably Syracuse, and there's a network there. How does it, in terms of contacts, how are you able to use that over the years to make yourself, you know, a better journalist and a better reporter?
It's alumni. Alumni help you so much. I was at a Met-Dodger game at Shea Stadium circa 1980, and I'm sitting in the press room eating, and Vin Scully sees my Fordham credential, and he comes over and sits near me and basically says, "How you doing? You're from Fordham?" And we talked a little bit about Fordham, and one of the things he said to me is, "Rich, always have a backup plan." Not that you're going to have to use a backup plan, but always have a plan that you can go to when times get tough in this industry. And there'll always be times getting tough in this industry. And it's something I never forgot. And I got a chance to go out to L.A. last year and see Vin in his last year. And it's amazing. I talked to him and thanked him. And he actually remembered the conversation because he quoted it. I was a nobody back then. In some ways, I'm still a nobody. And here's Vin Scully, who took the time out to tell me something that was so important in my career and remembered it decades later. That's got to tell you all you need to know about Vin Scully.
You know, as a reporter, I would have hoped that when you saw him in L.A., you asked Vince, so Vin, what is your backup plan now that you're retiring? So, you know, you mentioned SportsZone and AJ mentioned it, and, you know, I try to explain that to the kids that have no clue what SportsZone was. They can't even comprehend the concept. AJ and I have been lucky enough to have so many of the alums from SportsZone on the show, and they all have favorite SportsZone moments and stories. So could you explain to our younger audience what exactly SportsZone was in the context of the time that it was around, and what's your favorite SportsZone story?
Well, SportsZone was a company called Phone Programs, and they did a lot of the calling numbers. It wasn't just sports. They had astrology. They had all kinds of other stuff, which I won't kind of mention. And they had call-ins that you could call in and use the service. Well, we had 976-1313 was the phone number for SportsZone. And every 5 or 10 minutes, we would update scores. Now, remember, there's no internet. There's no bottom line. There's the only other way someone could get a score in those days was the 15 and 45 newscast on News Radio 88 and 1010 Wins. That was it. There was no WFAN. There was no 2020s. So we had it in three markets. We had it in Chicago, Detroit, and New York. And we learned how to build a sportscast. And I did a lot of work on the Chicago line, even more than I did on the New York line. And in Chicago, you always led with the Cubs score, then the White Sox score. Then you did the American League scores, and then back in the NL. And then and only then would you get to a Chicago Bull or Blackhawk score once you gave the Cubs score. The Cubs were it in Chicago. And you learned how to also take actualities and sound bites and incorporate them in a report, because we had a supplemental line called SportsZone Extra that did that. But the real interesting story was one day we're all sitting there, and this is when 900 numbers were getting to be their height. And we said, why don't we just have a 900 line for SportsZone? And Andy Roth, who was my boss at the time, was there. And we decided, well, let's just set up a bridge and do it. Well, what happened was people would call and stay on the line. Now, remember, this is also before college football had 78 games on a Saturday. You had your two games. I will never forget this one night. I'm on the live line, and this guy calls up, big Notre Dame fan. And he obviously had wagered a lot of money on the Notre Dame game. He was on the phone. Now, remember, it was 99 cents a minute. He was on the phone for 2.5 hours having me do play-by-play for him. Notre Dame actually covers the spread by, like, you know, punting the ball, getting a fumble, and getting a touchdown. The next day, a package comes to me at SportsZone. We were talking a lot about ourselves in the call, too. And he says, oh, what do you do on the side, Rich? I was bartending at the time. He goes, well, what do you like? I said, oh, Stoli's is the best drink in America. The next day at SportsZone, 3 cases of Stoli's showed up. I can only imagine how much the man wagered on that Notre Dame game. But that's my most fun story at SportsZone. Well,
you talk about you were on the phone with somebody who actually had called in. So the 900 was actually live talking to people as opposed to just the recorded broadcast and played over and play the clips.
Correct. And we knew the 900 line would work on a day, and Met fans will remember this that are my age, in the mid to late 80s in spring training, Kelly Gruber and Daryl Strawberry had a fist fight on the field. And we basically went on the 1-3 line, this is why I knew sports radio would work, and said, if you want details on the Kelly Gruber-Daryl Strawberry fight, call the 1-900 line. The 900 line that day had 970 calls, which came into them in a 3-hour period. We had to put a second bridge and get another guy to take calls. And that's the day I kind of knew that if sports talk radio ever came into this town, it would take off like wildfire.
Unbelievable. You know, one of the things you mentioned, it's maybe my it's a short little blurb in the book, but it's maybe my favorite story. And when I read it, I told AJ, wait till you get to this part. You mentioned your first meeting and encounter with the legendary Howard Cosell when you started working with him at WABC. Possibly my favorite story in the book. Could you share that with us?
Absolutely. I got the job at ABC Radio. It was an entry-level job. I was a production assistant, and I got to cover games on the nights I was off. So I had a 7-day, night-a-week schedule. And the first time Howard sees me, I guess it was either my first or second day there. And in those days, we're working on a typewriter. There's no computers. And Howard goes to me, "Who the hell are you?" And I said, "I'm Rich Catino. Who are you?" He goes, "Who am I? Who am I? I am the single most recognizable sports voice in America." I put my hand down. I said, "It's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Brent Musburger." And at that time, Brent and him were like bitter rivals. Right. He looked at me. I looked at him. There was dead silence. And then he started hysterically laughing. And when Howard would introduce me, we met at an ABC party. I'll never forget this one time. Al McGuire is at the party. He comes up to me and he goes, "Al, I wanted you to meet this kid. You know what this kid did to me the first time he met me?" Howard loved telling the story. And Howard and I became close. And one of the things I realized about Howard was he brought so much to the industry that he's never given credit for. And one of the last conversations I had with Howard, he was ill at the time. And I never met a man who loved his wife more than Howard did. And when she passed, we knew he wouldn't last long. And I get tearful-eyed when I think about this story because we're talking about it, and I asked him, "What was it like, the 69 Mets, covering that?" Because I covered the 86 Mets, but I never covered, you know, anything like that. He says, "New York became a small town." And I said, "What was Gil like?" And he said, "Gil was a great manager, but a better person." But he looked at me, knew this would make me feel good, and he said, "He would have absolutely loved you, Rich, because of the way you love the game." And I think about that story, and Howard did so many nice things for people, much like George Steinbrenner. Did so many nice things for people that he's never given credit for. And, you know, the funny thing about it with Howard is that when he was late in his career, he was stumbling over words. A lot of producers there said, "I don't want to produce this." I said, "You know what? Give it to me. This guy's given us so much in the world. Monday Night Football, which is a shell of its former self now, which I never thought would happen. But the reason why it was great and the reason it became a social event and the reason you still see bars on your street say, 'Come in for Monday Night Football,' is because of Howard Cosell. To me, he's a Hall of Fame broadcaster in every way. And I know that a lot of people don't feel that way, but I certainly do."
You know, one of my favorite things in the research for the Kiner's Corner book, and not many people realize this, I remember I called you that day. And I even put it on Facebook that Met fans don't realize the very first, you know, we all know Lindsay, you know, Bob Murphy and Ralph Kiner, you know, the Holy Trinity. But I asked people, "Do you know the first voice that Met fans heard on that first telecast?" And it was Howard Cosell doing Clubhouse Confidential, mm-hmm. which was the pregame show to the Mets' first broadcast. So Howard was had a pregame show for the 62 Mets. And it's something, you know, I posted the original one on there, which is pretty cool. What's the one thing that you learned, the biggest takeaway from working with Howard?
Something he said to me, and Mark, you know me well as a good friend, and you know I'm like this quote I'm about to say. What is right is not always popular, and what is popular is not always right. And I'll tell you, a lot of things in my book say that.
More true now than any time ever in our society.
The way Los Mets was treated, the way women were treated in the locker room when they first started, the way he gravitated to Muhammad Ali, before Muhammad Ali was this popular icon now. And there's a great story when the whole Mike Tyson thing was going on with the rape trial. Howard goes to me, "Oh, we got to work on this story. Rich, call this number. This guy will talk to you." So he gives me the number. I said, "Who is it?" He goes, "Just call him, Rich. Come on, don't give me grief." He didn't say grief. He said something worse, but I'll clean that up a little bit. And I pick up the phone. It's Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali said, "Oh, you're Rich Catino. He's the guy you told me about. Let's talk, and then we'll chat a little bit after the interview about your career." And I just said, Howard and Muhammad Ali came at the exact right time for each other. But they loved each other so much as men. And I look at it and I say, you had a white reporter and a black militant athlete, and they could find a way to get together. Why can't the rest of the world?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned about that he taught you that and what's right. However, I'm wondering if a certain incident didn't happen on a school bus with you and the way your dad handled it, mm-hmm. if what Howard said to you would have had as great an impact without that foundation. So could you share that story as to one of the reasons mm-hmm. why you have that racial, you know, view of race relations?
I was in high school. Went to Cardinal Spelman High School in the Bronx, which is still a high school I go to and go back and visit because it was four of the greatest years of my life. And we took a school bus every day. And one day I'm in the back of the school bus and a black youth just hit me right in the nose. And there was blood everywhere. And I threw this a punch back, and I think hit the air, and it probably would have not hurt him even if it hit him. All I wanted to do was get home. My parents took me to the emergency room, stitched it up. The reason there was so much blood is the bridge of my nose got hit, so there was blood everywhere. My red dress shirt was totally my white dress shirt was totally red. And we got back from the hospital, and my father came into my room, and he says, "Rich, I know you're probably upset at what happened today, and you have every right to be. But if you're thinking of retaliating against an innocent black person, it'll live with you for the rest of your life. It'll eat you alive. You got to get this out of your system. Be angry and understand it, that, you know, it's just something that happened to you. You're going to move past it." And later when I got into born-again Christianity, I was able to forgive the guy because who knows what happened in his life. And my father said something to me that night that really goes, "You know, Rich, you're not going to really understand ever what it's like to be a black person and walk down the street." And he said, "Understand this was a terrible thing that happened to you, but understand too that you're going to have black friends in your life. You may even have a black lover in your life. You may have all kinds of black people in your life that treat you well." And he said, "You have to be open arms to that." And my father said that to me circa early 70s when our neighborhood was changing. He understood it. And it's probably the most intelligent thing I've ever had anyone say to me in my entire life.
You know, you talk in the book, you name a lot of the people you like and you've learned a lot from. People, I also know Marty Noble was one, mm-hmm. mentioned Wally Matthews, mentioned Howie Rose. People say these are great people in the industry. And then you talk about things that you see that you don't like happening. What are the things, without even naming names, who are the people who really most bother you about being in the industry? And what do they do that most bothers you?
I think what bothers me the most is people who woke up when they were 25 or 30 and said, "This might be a good thing to do with my life." I think the people that are the best reporters and the best play-by-play men and women are the ones that had it in their soul from a young age. And let me tell you something. When sports gets in your soul, it doesn't ever leave. And I say it all the time, and I see reporters, they go on Twitter and they complain about their lives. They complain about, "Oh, I had to take a plane here, a plane there." Don't you realize that the world is filled with people that would do what you do for next to no pay? And I love those people because those are the people that make my job important. And I would never dismiss them. And even on Twitter, when someone says something that may get under my skin, I go by this proviso that he's saying it to me because he's listening to me, or she, and they're disagreeing with me, and that's fine. But he's also saying it because he has a passion for sports, the same passion that I have. We may be looking at it differently, but it's the same passion. And my problem with today's reporter is they look down on those people. They look askance at those people. And those are the people that make our profession what it is today. And that's the biggest problem I have. And I don't have to name names. I think people will know who the names are. And I think the Kevin Burkharts of the world and the Howie Roses of the world and the Gary Cohens of the world and the Susan Waldmans of the world and the Kim Joneses of the world, these are the broadcasting people I look up to because you can tell it's in their heart and soul and it got in there in an early age and it'll never leave.
Well, one of the things you also mentioned, and I see it firsthand also, is Listen. I'm in a different level, but we're radio, and I do get to cover the Rangers on a season basis and a lot of Met games. And when I go, I watch the game. You mentioned there are guys mm-hmm. in the press box that are so involved in their Twitter. They're so involved in doing other things.
That's the nature of the beast these days, though. They do it because they
have
to.
But is it? To me, see, this is one of the things I want to ask you, especially because this is the change mm-hmm. in media. To me, to go to a Met game, when people are either watching it or listening to it on the radio, I don't know how many people are looking at their Twitter feed to get play-by-play of the Met game. Because if you have access to your computer, you have access to the streaming audio. So why would you have a guy say, double by Lucas Duder on Twitter? Watch the game, watch it unfold. You have an observation for the game. That's something right. different. So is it the nature of the beast? Why are so many guys that are reporters tweeting out play-by-play of a game?
It's misuse of Twitter. What they should be doing, like example of the Met game today, maybe when the Mets are batting in the top of the eighth, say, the Mets got to bring Addison Reed in here to pitch the last two innings of this game. He's been off for 3 days. The Mets need the game. Those are the things that when I was growing up that I always talked about with friends when I was watching the game. So if Twitter is a conversational mode on social media, that's what should be the conversation should be. The conversation should not be, you know, eighth inning, oh, that's a double. It's even worse in spring training and in NFL training camps where they give you play-by-play where – John Gruden and I laughed about this up in ESPN one day, and John Gruden said, this is when coaches will sit there and say, God, we have to deal with these media people. They really are ignorant about the game. And Gruden has said it, and he showed me ways why they're ignorant about the game. And I sit there and I say, it's amazing. Football's a complicated game, and we try to make it so simplistic. Give the fans a little credit. They can understand the complexities if we take the time to talk about it. The fans aren't as simplistic as the media thinks they are.
Well, yes and no. In some respects, like, it bothers me on Twitter, and that's why I have not embraced Twitter, because you have people saying, like, you know, this player sucks, that player sucks. You know, this guy should never be in Major League. You know, even if that player is batting 123, he's among the greatest baseball players in the world to be on a major league roster. And for a guy just to sit there while he's watching television, this guy's or Alain Vigneault knows more in his pinky than every reporter that covers the Rangers combined. So when you question him, you know, and I'm guilty of it too. I talk about Terry Collins sometimes, but that's what we're supposed to do.
You know,
has Twitter gone too far?
The difference, Mark, Rich Ansmith, is it's editors also. They look at this and looking at this, and maybe it's the marketing people too, say you want to have that contact with your listener, with your reader, and the way to do it is to respond on Twitter. And there's pressure on the reporters to actually do this, not because they want to do it, because they like
Twitter following.
But it built a Twitter following, and that's part of the metrics. So, Rich, what do you see in terms of that?
I do, but I take a different tactic than that. When the Mets have a tough loss, I don't take it, well, let me pile on the Mets. I take it, let me try to be a psychiatrist for these people and talk them off the ledge just a little bit. Just a little bit, talk them off the ledge. And one of the things that's done for me in Twitter is it's created me as a standout Twitter in a different way. And my point on the whole thing is the editors do want it, but there are ways to do it so that you are not so much of, I'll give you a prime example. Michael Kodaira retired. I wrote about this in the book. And a young researcher who I think is terrific at what he does. I love the stuff he writes about the Mets. And he gets me to like looking at things. He said he was on the Met website and he saw that Michael Kodaira was on the retirement list. And when I called the Mets and the Mets said no comment, I knew the story had legs. But I wasn't going to take credit for the story. I let it evolve. A lot of the guys went on Twitter, the beat guys, and they trashed this guy. Oh, what are you making me do all this work for? Now I got to check this out. Turned out to be right. Kodaira broke the story on the Players Tribune, which is a whole other story. But I went on Twitter that night and gave credit to the young guy that did it because he deserved the credit for doing it. And I made sure of it. And there are people that beat reporters, colleagues that trashed me for it. And you know what? Trash me for it. But I got to be able to look at myself in the mirror next morning and understand that I didn't undercut someone else, especially someone that's trying to be in a career like I was once as a young person. He did something good. He deserved the credit for it. And to this day, me and him have talked about a lot of stuff in the Met minor league system, and he has so many good reads on players. And I think that I'm lucky to know him, and I wasn't going to trash him on a night when he needed me the most.
You know, you have a chapter in the book called Play-by-Play is Becoming a Lost Art. Mm-hmm. And you go on to name some of the great New York play-by-play voices. And you know, I'm wondering why you think that. I couldn't fully figure out from reading the chapter. You take a look, even in New York, you have the great, you know, voices like the Gary Cohns and the Mike Breens, which you mentioned. And, you know, in terms of especially New York writers, New York broadcasters for play-by-plays have not been homers. Unlike, you know, some of the ones, is it Ken Harrelson or Mike Shannon, I guess, with the Cardinals. Johnny Most is the one that I remember from up in Boston from the Celtics. Why do you feel that play-by-play is a lost art and what's lost?
Well, there are some homers in New York, and one of them is John Sterling. I think John's for the home team called John Sterling, you know, not necessarily the Yankees. But I do think that play-by-play has become a lost art because when I talk to young kids who are trying to do it, the first question they ask me is, how do I have to make my play-by-play call so it could be on Twitter? And when I hear play-by-play guys like John Sterling say to me, oh, yeah, I prepare for what I'm going to call this play, that's not play-by-play. It has to be spontaneous. Like when Bob Murphy said on the Buckner play, trickling. we all could be play-by-play guys. I would have never thought of the word trickling. He came up with it. Gary Cohen did it 2015 when the Mets clinched the division, saying tears of joy. It was the perfect description of what all Met fans were experiencing on that day. They were happy, so happy they were crying. So
Murphy, when I remember, they win the damn game.
Yeah, that's Murph. Awesome. Yeah,
and anything that Vin Scully does.
Yeah,
and I really think that I hopefully young kids that want to do play-by-play look at what the people did. Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and Ralph Kiner were homers. There's no doubt about it. But they were together 17 years and probably put together the best broadcasting team. And in those days, the radio guys and the TV guys were the same guys. So they really worked hard and worked 162 games, unlike today when they don't work 162 games. And I think that, you know, there's a part of me that misses that, but there's a part of me that also understands that personal branding becomes important for play-by-play guys, and John Sterling is my poster child for that.
It's interesting you mention that. We got like 3 minutes to try and wrap up three decades, which you do fabulously in the book. One of the changes you examine in the book is how, you know, the networks have affected the way, because right now the networks that cover the teams are basically PR machines. You have the YES Network for the Yankees, SNY for the Mets. How did that change the way announcers go about their business? And for you, what's the best change over the three decades and the worst change?
Well, I would say the teams owning networks, when YES came about, I said to myself, this must be like what the government-run radio station was in the Soviet Union. Because if you listen to the YES Network in those days, it was like, the Yankees can solve world peace, just give them 2 minutes and they'll be able to do it. I think SNY did very differently. First of all, they weren't just a Met. They didn't just cover the Mets. They covered everybody. And I knew when the Willie Randolph firing occurred on that day that SNY was different, because a lot of organizations would have tried to censor what Kevin Burkhardt and Gary Cohen were saying, and they didn't. They came right out and said it and covered it that way. I think YES and SNY both proved you could win and have revenue going both those ways. I'm not saying one way is right and the other way isn't right. They're just different. The biggest change, I think, though, in broadcasting took place when Fox came as the fourth network, because now rights fees went into the heavens, and now these leagues said to themselves, okay, we could take some of our games and have a network buy rights fees, and then we can have our own network and bring in the affiliate dollars, okay, because now this Met National game in September is going to be on the MLB network. And we not only that, but we own that, and once we can get the carriage in the cable systems across where we need to go, we have the two-goal revenue stream just like the networks do, only we own everything. And I think that networks saw that, and that's the biggest change that I saw. I think the most positive change that I've seen in the media is that pre- and post-game shows really give fans a view of baseball and all the sports that they haven't gotten. And I think on the radio side, Howie Rose was the pioneer for it, and on the TV side, Kevin Burkhardt did it better than anyone I've ever been around, and I think better than anyone I'll ever see. And Kevin Burkhardt is as big a reason for the success of SNY, in addition to the Mets playing well, as any on-air person there. Kevin Burkhardt really brought the fans into SNY and into his life. And we can see now how he works at Fox. He's got to be he's like the teacher in school, and he's got to make sure that Pete Rose doesn't go off and Frank Thomas doesn't go off, and at the same time bring A-Rod, who I think's terrific on the air. I think A-Rod has a great career ahead of him broadcasting. He brings A-Rod, and A-Rod, when I've talked to A-Rod over the years about hitting, I always learned something about hitting that I didn't know before. And A-Rod's brought that to the mix. But Burkhardt and Howie Rose, they are Hall of Fame broadcasters in every way. And I hope to be up in Cooperstown when Howie Rose gets in, because when he's there, that's going to be a great day.
Excellent, excellent stuff. Where's the best place for people to get this wonderful new book?
You can get it at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. All the Barnes & Noble scores. Also, Target.com. I'm going to have a few book signings. I'm going to have one up in Stamford, Connecticut at the Barnes & Noble a week from today at 1 o'clock. And then a week from tomorrow, the 22nd, we're going to be in the city to one of the greatest sports bars, Foley's New York, ever created. And we're going to have a night, just not a book signing. We're going to watch some hockey. We're going to watch some baseball. We're going to have a good time. And I'll have some sodas, and you guys will have some beers. How about that?
Sounds good. Maybe Bobby V will show up in Stamford as well.
Yeah.
All right, Rich, we'd love you to hang out with us the rest of the show as well. Rich Catino, Mets beat reporter, author of the great new book, Press Box Revolution, available everywhere now.